Case 3. If France is so embroiled by a war with another state that she cannot proceed against Germany, our first objective must be to overthrow Czechoslovakia and Austria simultaneously in order to remove the threat to our flank in any possible operation against the West. If the Czechs were overthrown and a common German-Hungarian frontier achieved, a neutral attitude on the part of Poland could be the more certainly counted upon in the event of a Franco-German conflict. But what would France, Britain, Italy, and Russia do? Hitler went into the answer to that question in considerable detail. He believed that almost certainly Britain and probably France had already tacitly written off the Czechs. Difficulties connected with the empire and the prospect of being once more entangled in a protracted European war were decisive considerations for Britain against participation in a war against Germany. Britain's attitude would certainly not be without influence on that of France. An attack by France without British support, and with the prospect of the offensive being brought to a standstill on our western fortifications, was hardly probable. Nor was a French march through Belgium and Holland without British support to be expected. It would, of course, be necessary to maintain a strong defense on our western frontier during the prosecution of our attack on the Czechs and Austria. Hitler then outlined some of the advantages of the annexation of Czechoslovakia and Austria. Better strategic frontiers for Germany, the freeing of military forces for other purposes, acquisition of some 12 million Germans, additional foodstuffs for 5 to 6 million Germans in the Reich, and manpower for 12 new army divisions. He had forgotten to mention what Italy and Russia might do, and he now returned to them. He doubted whether the Soviet Union would intervene in view of Japan's attitude. Italy would not object to the elimination of the Czechs, but it was still a question as to her attitude if Austria was also taken. It depended essentially on whether the Duce were still alive. Hitler's supposition for Case 3 was that France would become embroiled in a war with Italy, a conflict that he counted upon. That was the reason, he explained, for his policy in trying to prolong the Spanish Civil War. It kept Italy embroiled with France and Britain. He saw a war between them coming definitely nearer. In fact, he said he was resolved to take advantage of it whenever it happened, even as early as 1938, which was just 2 months away. He was certain that Italy, with a little German help in raw materials, could stand off Britain and France. If Germany made use of this war to settle the Czech and Austrian questions, it was to be assumed that Britain, herself at war with Italy, would decide not to act against Germany. Without British support, a warlike action by France against Germany was not to be expected. The time for our attack on the Czechs and Austria must be made dependent on the course of the Anglo-French-Italian War. This favorable situation would not occur again. The descent upon the Czechs would have to be carried out with lightning speed. Thus, as evening darkened Berlin on that autumn day of November 5, 1937, the meeting broke up at 8:15, the die was cast. Hitler had communicated his irrevocable decision to go to war. To the handful of men who would have to direct it, there could no longer be any doubt. The dictator had said it all 10 years before in Mein Kampf, had said that Germany must have Lebensraum in the East and must be prepared to use force to obtain it. But then he had only been an obscure agitator, and his book, as Field Marshal von Blomberg later said, had been regarded by the soldiers, as by so many others, as a piece of propaganda whose large circulation was due to forced sales. But now the Wehrmacht chiefs and the foreign minister were confronted with specific dates for actual aggression against two neighboring countries, an action which they were sure would bring on a European war. They must be ready by the following year, 1938, and at the latest by 1943-45. The realization stunned them. Not, so far as the Hossbach records show, because they were struck down by the immorality of their leaders' proposals, but for more practical reasons. Germany was not ready for a big war. To provoke one now would risk disaster. On those grounds, Blomberg, Fritsch, and Neurath dared to speak up and question the Führer's pronouncement. Within 3 months, all of the three were out of office, and Hitler, relieved of their opposition, such as it was, and it was the last he was to suffer in his presence during the Third Reich, set out on the road of the conqueror to fulfill his destiny. In the beginning, it was an easier road than he, or anyone else, had foreseen. Chapter 10 Strange, Fateful Interlude. The Fall of Blomberg, Fritsch, Neurath, and Schacht. The decision to use armed force against Austria and Czechoslovakia, even if it involved Germany in a war with Great Britain and France, which Hitler laid down on November 5th, came as such a shock to his foreign minister that Baron von Neurath, easygoing, complacent, and morally weak though he was, suffered several heart attacks. "I was extremely upset at Hitler's speech," he later told the Nuremberg Tribunal, "because it knocked the bottom out of the whole foreign policy which I had consistently pursued." In this frame of mind, and despite his heart attacks, he sought out General von Fritsch and General Beck, chief of the general staff, 2 days later, and discussed with them what could be done to get Hitler to change his ideas. The impression on Beck of Hitler's harangue, according to Colonel Hosbach, who informed him of it, had been shattering. It was agreed that Fritsch should again remonstrate with the Führer at their next appointment, pointing out to him the military considerations which made his plans inadvisable, while Neurath would follow up by again stressing to Hitler the political dangers. As for Beck, he immediately committed to paper a devastating critique of Hitler's plans, which apparently he showed to no one. The first sign of a fatal flaw in the mind and character of this estimable general, who at first had welcomed the advent of Nazism and who, in the end, would give his life in an abortive effort to destroy it. General von Fritsch saw Hitler on November 9th. There is no record of their talk, but it may be presumed that the commander-in-chief of the army repeated his military arguments against Hitler's plans, and that he got nowhere. The Führer was in no mood to brook opposition, either from the generals or from his foreign minister. He refused to receive Neurath and took off for a long rest at his mountain retreat at Berchtesgaden. It was not until the middle of January that the stricken Neurath was able to arrange an appointment with the leader. "On that occasion I tried to show him," Neurath later testified at Nuremberg, "that his policy would lead to a world war, and that I would have no part in it. I called his attention to the danger of war and to the serious warnings of the generals. When, despite all my arguments, he still held to his opinions, I told him that he would have to find another foreign minister." Though Neurath did not then know it, that was precisely what Hitler had decided to do. In a fortnight he would celebrate the 5th anniversary of his coming to power, and he intended to mark it by cleaning house not only in the Foreign Office but in the army. Those two citadels of upper-class reaction, which he secretly distrusted, which he felt had never completely accepted him nor really understood his aims, and which, as Blomberg, Fritsch, and Neurath had shown on the evening of November 5th, stood in the way of realizing his ambitions. The last two gentlemen in particular, and perhaps even the accommodating Blomberg, to whom he owed so much, would have to follow the inimitable Dr. Schacht into retirement. For the crafty financier, the early enthusiast for Nazism and backer of Hitler, had already fallen. Schacht, as we have seen, had devoted his energies and his wizardry to financing Hitler's speedy rearmament. As plenipotentiary for war economy, as well as minister of economics, he had concocted any number of fancy schemes, including the use of the printing press, to raise the money for the new army, navy, and air force, and to pay the armament bills. But there was a limit beyond which the country could not go without becoming bankrupt, and by 1936 he believed Germany was approaching that limit. He warned Hitler, Goering, and Blomberg, but to little avail, though the war minister for a time sided with him. With Goering's appointment in September 1936 as plenipotentiary for the four-year plan, a far-fetched scheme to make Germany self-sufficient in 4 years, a goal which Schacht regarded as impossible, the Luftwaffe chief became, in fact, the economic dictator of Germany. To a man as vain and ambitious and as contemptuous of Goering's ignorance of economics as Schacht was, this made his own position untenable, and after months of violent controversy between the two strong-minded men, Schacht asked the Führer to place the further direction of economic policies solely in his rival's hand, and to allow him to resign his post in the cabinet. The astute French ambassador, François Poncet, who knew him well, says in his book The Fateful Years, page 221, that at one time Schacht had hoped to succeed Hindenburg as president, and even Hitler, should things go ill with the Führer. To add to his discouragement had been the attitude of many of the nation's leading industrialists and businessmen, who, as he later recounted, crowded into Goering's anteroom in the hope of getting orders when I was still trying to make the voice of reason heard. To make the voice of reason heard in the frenzied atmosphere of Nazi Germany in 1937 was an impossible task, as Schacht realized. And after a further exchange of blows with Goering during the summer in which he denounced as unsound, "Your foreign exchange policy, your policy regarding production, and your financial policy," he traveled down to the Obersalzberg in August to submit his formal resignation to Hitler. The Führer was loath to accept it in view of the unfavorable reaction both at home and abroad which the departure of Schacht would almost certainly bring. But the battered minister was adamant, and Hitler finally agreed to release him at the end of 2 months. On September 5th, Schacht went on leave, and his resignation was formally accepted on December 8th. At Hitler's insistence, Schacht remained in the cabinet as minister without portfolio, and retained the presidency of the Reichsbank, thus preserving appearances and blunting the shock to German and world opinion. His influence as a brake on Hitler's feverish rearmament for war, however, had come to an end, though by remaining in the cabinet and at the Reichsbank he continued to lend the aura of his name and reputation to Hitler's purposes. Indeed, he would shortly endorse publicly and enthusiastically the leader's first gangster act of naked aggression. For, like the generals and the other conservatives who had played such a key role in turning over Germany to the Nazis, he was slow to awaken to the facts of life. Goering took over temporarily the Ministry of Economics, but one evening in mid-January 1938, Hitler ran into Walter Funk at the opera in Berlin, and casually informed him that he would be Schacht's successor. The official appointment of this greasy, dwarfish, servile non-entity who, it will be remembered, had played a certain role in interesting business leaders in Hitler in the early 30s, was held up, however. For there now burst upon the Third Reich a two-headed crisis in the army, which was precipitated by, among all things, certain matters pertaining to sex, both normal and abnormal, and which played directly into the hands of Hitler, enabling him to deal a blow to the old aristocratic military hierarchy from which it never recovered, with dire consequences not only for the army, which thereby lost the last vestiges of independence which it had guarded so zealously during the Hohenzollern Empire and the Republic, but eventually for Germany and the world. The Fall of Field Marshal von Blomberg. What influence a woman, even without realizing it, can exert on the history of a country and thereby on the world, Colonel Alfred Jodl exclaimed in his diary on January 26th, 1938. One has the feeling of living in a fateful hour for the German people. The woman this brilliant young staff officer referred to was Fräulein Erna Grün, and as the year 1937 approached its end, she must have regarded herself as the last person in Germany who could possibly propel, as Jodl declared, the German people into a fateful crisis and exercise a profound influence on their history. Perhaps only in the eerie, psychopathic world in which the inner circle of the Third Reich moved at this time with such frenzy would it have been possible. Fräulein Grün was the secretary of Blomberg, and toward the end of 1937 he felt sufficiently enamored of her to suggest marriage. His first wife, the daughter of a retired army officer, whom he had married in 1904, had died in 1932. His five children, in the meantime, had grown up. His youngest daughter had married the oldest son of General Keitel, his protégé, in 1937. And tiring of his somewhat lonely widowerhood, he decided the time had come to remarry. Realizing that for the senior officer of the German army to wed a commoner would not go down well with the haughty aristocratic officer corps, he sought out Goering for advice. Goering could see no objection to the marriage, had he himself not married after the death of his first wife, a divorced actress. There was no place in the Third Reich for the stodgy social prejudices of the officer corps. Goering not only approved what Blomberg had in mind, he declared himself ready to smooth matters over with Hitler, if that were necessary, and to help in any other way. As it happened, there was another way he could be helpful. There was a rival lover involved, the field marshal confided. To Goering, that was no problem. Such nuisances in other cases had been carted off to concentration camp. Probably out of consideration for the old-fashioned morals of the field marshal, Goering, however, offered to ship the troublesome rival off to South America, which he did. Still, Blomberg felt troubled. On December 15, 1937, Jodl made a curious entry in his diary. The general field marshal, Blomberg, in a high state of excitement, reason not known. Apparently a personal matter, he retired for 8 days to an unknown place. On December 22nd, Blomberg reappeared to deliver the funeral oration for General Ludendorff at the Feldherrnhalle in Munich. Hitler was there but declined to speak. The World War hero had refused to have anything to do with him ever since he had fled from in front of the Feldherrnhalle after the volley of bullets during the beer hall putsch. After the funeral, Blomberg broached the matter of his proposed marriage to Hitler. The Führer, to his relief, gave it his blessing. The wedding took place on January 12, 1938, and Hitler and Göring were present as the principal witnesses. Hardly had the bridal pair taken off for Italy on their honeymoon, then the storm broke. The rigid officer corps might have absorbed the shock of their field marshal marrying his stenographer, but they were not prepared to accept his marriage to a woman with a past such as now began to come to light in all its horrific details. At first there were only rumors. Anonymous telephone calls began to be received by stiff-necked generals from giggling girls, apparently calling from unsavory cafes and nightclubs, congratulating the army for having accepted one of their number. At police headquarters in Berlin, a police inspector, checking on the rumors, came upon a file marked Erna Grun. Horrified, he took it to the police chief, Count von Heldorf. The Count, a roughneck veteran of the Freikorps and the brawling days of the SA, was horrified too. For the dossier showed that the bride of the field marshal and commander-in-chief had a police record as a prostitute, and had been convicted of having posed for pornographic photographs. The young Frau Field Marshal, it developed, had grown up in a massage salon run by her mother, which, as sometimes happened in Berlin, was merely a camouflage for a brothel. It was obviously Heldorf's duty to pass along the damaging dossier to his superior, the chief of the German police, Himmler. But ardent Nazi though he was, he had formerly been a member of the Army Officer Corps himself, and had absorbed some of its traditions. He knew that Himmler, who had been feuding with the Army High Command for more than a year and was now coming to be regarded by it as more of a sinister threat than Röhm had been, would use the file to blackmail the Field Marshal and make him his tool against the conservative generals. Courageously, Heldorf took the police papers to General Keitel instead. He apparently was convinced that Keitel, who owed his recent rise in the Army to Blomberg, to whom he was attached by family ties, would arrange for the officer corps itself to handle the affair, and would also warn his chief of the peril he was in. But Keitel, an arrogant and ambitious man, though of feeble mind and moral character, had no intention of risking his career by getting into trouble with the party and the SS. Instead of passing on the papers to the army chief, General von Fritsch, he gave them back to Heldorf with the suggestion that he show them to Göring. No one could have been more pleased to possess them than Göring, for it was obvious that Blomberg now would have to go, and logical, he thought, that he himself should succeed him as commander-in-chief of the Wehrmacht, a goal he had long had in mind. Blomberg interrupted his honeymoon in Italy to return to Germany for the funeral of his mother, and on January 20th, still unmindful of what was brewing, appeared at his office in the War Ministry to resume his duties. But not for long. On January 25th, Göring brought the explosive documents to Hitler, who had just returned from Berchtesgaden, and the Führer blew up. His field marshal had deceived him and made him, who was an official witness at the wedding, look like a fool. Göring quickly agreed with him, and at noon went off to see Blomberg personally and break the news to him. The field marshal appears to have been overwhelmed by the revelations about his bride and offered to divorce her at once. But this, Göring politely explained, would not be enough. The army command itself was demanding his resignation. As Jodl's diary of 2 days later reveals, the chief of the general staff, General Beck, had informed Keitel that one cannot tolerate the highest-ranking soldier marrying a whore. On January 25th, Jodl learned through Keitel that Hitler had dismissed his field marshal. 2 days later, the 60-year-old fallen officer left Berlin for Capri to resume his honeymoon. To this idyllic island he was pursued by his naval adjutant, who provided the final grotesque touch to this singular tragicomedy. Admiral Raeder had dispatched this aide, Lieutenant von Wangenheim, to demand of Blomberg that for the sake of the honor of the officer corps, he divorce his wife. The junior naval officer was an arrogant and extremely zealous young man, and when he arrived in the presence of the honeymooning field marshal, he exceeded his instructions. Instead of asking for a divorce, he suggested that his former chief do the honorable thing, whereupon he attempted to thrust a revolver into Blomberg's hand. Despite his fall, however, the field marshal seemed to have retained a zest for life. Obviously, he was still enamored of his bride, notwithstanding all that had happened. He declined to take the proffered weapon, remarking, as he immediately wrote to Keitel, that he and the young naval officer apparently had quite different views and standards of life. After all, the Führer had held out to him the prospect of further employment at the highest level as soon as the storm blew over. According to Jodl's diary, Hitler told Blomberg during the interview in which he dismissed him that, "As soon as Germany's hour comes, you will again be by my side, and everything that has happened in the past will be forgotten." Indeed, Blomberg wrote in his unpublished memoirs that Hitler, at their final meeting, promised him, with the greatest emphasis, that he would be given the supreme command of the armed forces in the event of war. Like so many other promises of Hitler, this one was not kept. Field Marshal von Blomberg's name was stricken forever from the army rolls, and not even when the war came and he offered his services was he restored to duty in any capacity. After their return to Germany, Blomberg and his wife settled in the Bavarian village of Wiese, where they lived in complete obscurity until the end of the war. As was the case of a former English king of the same era, he remained to the end loyal to the wife who had brought his downfall. That end came with his death on March 13, 1946, in Nuremberg jail, where he was waiting, a pitiful, emaciated man, to testify in the trial. The Fall of General Freiherr Werner von Fritsch. Colonel General Freiherr Werner von Fritsch, the commander-in-chief of the army and a gifted and unbending officer of the old school, a typical general staff character, Admiral Raeder called him, was the obvious candidate to succeed Blomberg as Minister of War and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. But Goering himself, as we have seen, had his eye on the top post, and there were some who believed that he had deliberately pushed Blomberg into his marriage with a woman whose unfortunate past he may have had prior knowledge of, in order to clear the way for himself. If this was true, Blomberg did not know it, for during his farewell interview with Hitler on January 27th, he at first suggested Goering as his successor. The Führer, however, knew his old Nazi henchman better than anyone else. Goering, he said, was too self-indulgent and lacked both patience and diligence. Nor did he favor General von Fritsch, whose opposition to his grandiose plans on November 5th he had not liked or forgotten. Moreover, Fritsch's hostility to the Nazi party and especially to the SS had never been concealed, a circumstance which not only had attracted the attention of the Führer, but had provoked in Heinrich Himmler, the SS leader and chief of police, a growing determination to overthrow this formidable antagonist who led the army. On March 1, 1935, the day Germany took over the Tsar, I stood next to Fritsch in the reviewing stand at Saarbrücken for some time before the parade started. Although he scarcely knew me, except as one of the many American correspondents in Berlin, he poured out a running fire of sarcastic remarks about the SS, the party, and various Nazi leaders, from Hitler on down. He did not disguise his contempt for them all. See Berlin Diary, page 27. Himmler's opportunity now came, or rather, he created it by setting in motion a frame-up so outrageous that it is difficult to believe that it could have happened, at least in 1938, even in the gangster-ridden world of the SS and the National Socialist Party, or that the German army, which after all did have its traditions, would have stood for it. Coming on the heels of the Blomberg scandal, it set off a second and much more explosive bomb, which rocked the officer corps to its foundation and settled its fate. On January 25th, the day on which Goering was showing Hitler the police record of Blomberg's bride, he also spread before the Führer an even more damaging document. This had been conveniently provided by Himmler and his principal aide Heydrich, chief of the SD, the SS Security Service, and it purported to show that General von Fritsch had been guilty of homosexual offenses under Section 175 of the German Criminal Code, and that he had been paying blackmail to an ex-convict since 1935 to hush the matter up. The Gestapo papers seemed so conclusive that Hitler was inclined to believe the charge, and Blomberg, perhaps venting his resentment at Fritsch for the severe attitude the army had taken toward him because of his marriage, did nothing to dissuade him. Fritsch, he confided, was not a woman's man, and he added that the general, a lifelong bachelor, might well have succumbed to weakness. Colonel Hosbach, the Führer's adjutant who was present when the Gestapo file was shown, was horrified and, in defiance of Hitler's orders that he was to say nothing to Fritsch, went immediately to the army commander's apartment to inform him of the charge and to warn him of the dire trouble he was in. This cost Hosbach his job 2 days later, but not, as some feared, his life. He was restored to the army general staff, rose during the war to the rank of general of the infantry, and commanded the Fourth Army on the Russian front until abruptly dismissed by Hitler by telephone on January 28, 1945, for withdrawing his troops in defiance of the Führer's orders. The taciturn Prussian nobleman was stupefied. "A lot of stinking lies," he blurted out. When he had calmed down, he assured his brother officer on his word of honor that the charges were utterly baseless. Early the next morning, Hosbach, fearless of the consequences, told Hitler of his meeting with Fritsch, reported the general's categorical denial of the accusations, and urged that the Führer give him a hearing and the opportunity of personally denying his guilt. To this, Hitler, to Hosbach's surprise, assented, and the commander-in-chief of the German army was summoned to the chancellery late on the evening of the same day. He was there to undergo an experience for which his long training as an aristocrat, an officer, and a gentleman had scarcely prepared him. The meeting took place in the chancellery library, and this time Himmler as well as Goering was present. After Hitler had summed up the charges, Fritsch gave his word of honor as an officer that they were completely untrue. But such assurances no longer had much value in the Third Reich, and now Himmler, who had been waiting for 3 years for this moment, introduced a shuffling, degenerate-looking figure from a side door. He must have been one of the strangest, if not the most disreputable, figures ever let into the offices of the Chancellor of Germany. His name was Hans Schmidt, and he had a long prison record dating back to his first sentence to a boys' reformatory. His chief weakness, it developed, had been spying on homosexuals and then blackmailing them. He now professed to recognize General von Fritsch as the army officer whom he had caught in a homosexual offense in a dark alley near the Potsdam railroad station in Berlin, with an underworld character by the name of Bavarian Joe. The name is supplied by Gisevius in To the Bitter End, page 229. For years, Schmidt insisted to the three most powerful figures in Germany, this officer had paid him blackmail to keep quiet, the payments only ceasing when the law again clamped him behind the bars of a penitentiary. General Freiherr von Fritsch was too outraged to answer. The spectacle of the head of the German state, the successor of Hindenburg and the Hohenzollerns, introducing such a shady character in such a place for such a purpose, was too much for him. His speechlessness only helped to convince Hitler that he was guilty, and the Führer asked for his resignation. This Fritsch declined to give, demanding in turn a trial by a military court of honor. But Hitler had no intention of allowing the military caste to take over the case, at least for the moment. This was a heaven-sent opportunity, which he would not let pass, to smash the opposition of the generals who would not bend to his will and genius. He then and there ordered Fritsch to go on indefinite leave, which was equivalent to his suspension as commander-in-chief of the army. The next day, Hitler conferred with Keitel about a successor not only to Blomberg, but to Fritsch. Jodl, whose chief source of information was Keitel, began sprinkling his diary with entries which indicated that a drastic shake-up not only in the army command, but in the whole organization of the armed forces was being worked out, which would at last bring the military to heel. Would the senior generals surrender their power, which, though by no means absolute, was the last that remained outside the grip of Hitler? When Fritsch returned to his apartment in the Bendlerstrasse from the ordeal in the Chancellery Library, he conferred with General Beck, the chief of the Army General Staff. Some English historians have recounted that Beck urged him to carry out a military putsch at once against the Hitler government, and that Fritsch declined. But Wolfgang Förster, the German biographer of Beck, who had the general's personal papers at his disposal, states merely that on the fateful evening Beck saw first Hitler, who apprised him of the grave charges, then Fritsch, who denied them, and that finally, late on the same evening, he hurried back to Hitler to demand only that the army commander be given a chance to clear himself before a military court of honor. Beck, too, his biographer makes clear, had not yet attained that understanding of the rulers of the Third Reich which was later to come to him, when it was too late. Some days later, when it was also too late, when not only Blomberg and Fritsch were gone, but 16 of the senior generals retired and 44 others transferred to lesser commands, Fritsch and his closest associates, of whom Beck was one, did seriously consider military countermeasures. But they quickly abandoned such dangerous thoughts. It was clear to these men, Förster says, that a military putsch would mean civil war and was by no means sure of success. Then, as always, the German generals wanted to be sure of winning before taking any great risks. They feared, as this German writer states, that not only would Goering's Air Force and Admiral Raeder's Navy oppose them, since both commanders were completely under the Führer's spell, but that the army itself might not fully support its fallen commander-in-chief. However, one last chance was given the ranking army officers to deal a blow in their turn to Hitler. A preliminary investigation conducted by the army in collaboration with the Ministry of Justice quickly established that General von Fritsch was the innocent victim of a Gestapo frame-up initiated by Himmler and Heydrich. It was found that the ex-convict Schmidt had indeed caught an army officer in an unnatural act in the shadows of the Potsdam station, and had successfully blackmailed him for years. But his name was Frisch, not Fritsch, and he was a bedridden retired cavalry officer listed in the army rolls as Rittmeister von Frisch. This the Gestapo had known, but it had arrested Schmidt and threatened him with death unless he pointed the finger to the commander-in-chief of the army. The ailing Rittmeister also was taken into custody by the secret police so as to prevent him from talking, but both he and Schmidt were eventually wrested from the Gestapo's clutches by the army and kept in a safe place until they could testify at the court-martial of Fritsch. The old leaders of the army were jubilant. Not only would their commander-in-chief be vindicated and restored to his leadership of the army, the machinations of the SS and the Gestapo, of those two unscrupulous men, Himmler and Heydrich, who held such unbridled power in the country, would be exposed, and they and the SS would go the way of Röhm and the SA 4 years before. It would be a blow, too, to the party and to Hitler himself. It would shake the foundations of the Third Reich so violently that the Führer himself might topple over. If he tried to cover up the crime, the army itself, with a clear conscience, now that the truth was known, would take matters in its own hands. But once again, as so often in the past 5 years, the generals were outsmarted by the former Austrian corporal and then utterly defeated by fate, which the leader, if not they, knew how to take advantage of for his own ends. All through the last week of January 1938, a tension, reminiscent of that of late June 1934, gripped Berlin. Again, the capital seethed with rumors. Hitler had dismissed the two top men in the army for reasons unknown. The generals were in revolt. They were plotting a military putsch. Ambassador François Poncet heard that Fritsch, who had invited him to dinner for February 2nd, and then cancelled the invitation, had been arrested. There were reports that the army planned to surround the Reichstag, when it met to hear Hitler's fifth anniversary speech on January 30th, and arrest the entire Nazi government and its hand-picked deputies. Credence of such reports grew when it was announced that the meeting of the Reichstag had been indefinitely postponed. The German dictator was obviously in difficulties. He had met his match at last in the unbending senior generals of the German army. Or so the latter must have thought, but they were in error. On February 4, 1938, the German cabinet met for what was to prove the last time. Whatever difficulties Hitler had experienced, he now resolved them in a manner which eliminated those who stood in his way, not only in the army but in the Foreign Office. A decree which he hastily put through the cabinet that day and which was announced to the nation and the world on the radio shortly before midnight began, "From now on, I take over personally the command of the whole armed forces." As head of state, Hitler, of course, had been the supreme commander of the armed forces, but now he took over Blomberg's office of commander-in-chief and abolished the war ministry, over which the now moonstruck bridegroom had also presided. In its place was created the organization which was to become familiar to the world during World War II, the High Command of the Armed Forces, Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, or OKW, to which the three fighting services, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, were subordinated. Hitler was its supreme commander, and under him was a chief of staff, with the high-sounding title of Chief of the High Command of the Armed Forces, a post which went to the toady Keitel, who managed to keep it to the end. To assuage the wounded feelings of Goering, who had been confident of succeeding Blomberg, Hitler named him a field marshal, which made him the ranking officer of the Reich and apparently pleased him no end. To calm the uneasiness of the public, Hitler announced that Blomberg and Fritsch had resigned for reasons of health. Thus, Fritsch was got rid of once and for all, even before his trial by a military court of honor, which Hitler knew would exonerate him. This seemed particularly outrageous to the senior generals, but there was nothing they could do about it, for they were sent into the discard in the same decree. 16 of them, including generals von Rundstedt, von Leib, von Witzleben, von Kluge, and von Kleist, were relieved of their commands, and 44 others, who were regarded as less than enthusiastic in their devotion to Nazism, were transferred. As Fritsch's successor to command the army, Hitler, after some hesitation, picked General Walter von Brauchitsch, who enjoyed a good reputation among the generals, but who was to prove as weak and as compliant as Blomberg when it came to standing up to the mercurial temperament of Hitler. For a few days during the crisis, it appeared that a problem of sex would prove Brauchitsch's undoing, as it had that of Blomberg and Fritsch. For this officer was on the point of getting a divorce, an action frowned upon by the military aristocracy. The ever-curious Jodl noted the complication in his diary. On Sunday, January 30th, he recorded that Keitel had called in Brauchitsch's son in order to send him to his mother. He is to get her assent to the divorce. And a couple of days later, he reported a meeting of Brauchitsch and Keitel with Goering for a discussion of the family situation. Goering, who seemed to have made himself an arbiter of the sex difficulties of the generals, promised to look into the matter. On the same day, Jodl further noted, the son of Brauchitsch returns with a very dignified letter from his mother. The inference was that she would not stand in her husband's way. Nor would Goering and Hitler disapprove of a divorce, which the new commander of the army actually obtained a few months after assuming his new post. For both of them knew that Frau Charlotte Schmidt, the woman he wanted to marry, was, as Ulrich von Hassel said, a 200% rabid Nazi. The marriage took place in the following autumn, and was to prove, as Jodl might have noted again, another instance of the influence of a woman on history. According to Milton Schulman, Defeat in the West, page 10, Hitler himself intervened with the first Frau von Brauchitsch in order to obtain her consent to the divorce, and helped provide a financial settlement for her, thus putting the army commander-in-chief under personal obligation to him. Schulman gives as his source a Canadian Army intelligence report. Hitler's house cleaning of February 4th was not confined to the generals. He also swept Neurath out of the Foreign Office, replacing him with the shallow and compliant Ribbentrop. To divert attention from the military crisis and to save something of Neurath's prestige both at home and abroad, Hitler, at Goering's suggestion, created the so-called Secret Cabinet Council, Geheimer Kabinettsrat, whose purpose, said the Führer's February 4th decree, was to furnish him guidance in the conduct of foreign policy. Neurath was appointed its president, and its members included Keitel and the chiefs of the three armed services, as well as the most important members of the ordinary cabinet and of the party. Goebbels's propaganda machine gave it much fanfare, making it look as if it were a super-cabinet, and that Neurath actually had been promoted. Actually, the secret cabinet council was pure fiction. It never existed. As Goering testified at Nuremberg, there was, to be sure, no such cabinet in existence, but the expression would sound quite nice, and everyone would imagine that it meant something. I declare under oath that this secret cabinet council never met at all, not even for a minute. Two veteran career diplomats, Ulrich von Hassel, the ambassador in Rome, and Herbert von Dirksen, the ambassador in Tokyo, were relieved, as was Papen in Vienna. The weakling Funk was formally named as the successor of Schacht as Minister of Economics. The next day, February 5th, there were screaming headlines in the Völkischer Beobachter. Strongest concentration of all powers in the Führer's hands. For once, the leading daily Nazi newspaper did not exaggerate. February 4, 1938, is a major turning point in the history of the Third Reich, a milestone on its road to war. On that date, the Nazi revolution, it might be said, was completed. The last of the conservatives who stood in the way of Hitler's embarking upon the course which he had long determined to follow, once Germany was sufficiently armed, were swept away. Blomberg, Fritsch, and Neurath had been put in office by Hindenburg and the old-school conservatives to act as a brake upon Nazi excesses, and Schacht to join them. But in the struggle for control of the foreign and economic policy and the military power of Germany, they proved to be no match for Hitler. They had neither the moral strength nor the political shrewdness to stand up to him, let alone to triumph over him. Schacht quit. Neurath stepped aside. Blomberg, under pressure from his own brother generals, resigned. Fritsch, though he was framed in gangster fashion, accepted his dismissal without a gesture of defiance. 16 top generals meekly accepted theirs, and his. There was talk in the officer corps of a military putsch, but only talk. Hitler's contempt for the Prussian officer caste, which he held till the end of his life, proved quite justified. It had accepted with scarcely a murmur the officially condoned murder of Generals von Schleicher and von Bredow. It was swallowing supinely now the cashiering of its senior officers. Was not Berlin swarming with younger generals eager to replace them, eager to serve him? Where was the vaunted solidarity of the army officers? Was it not a myth? For 5 years up to this winter day of February 4, 1938, the army had possessed the physical power to overthrow Hitler and the Third Reich. When it learned on November 5, 1937, where he was leading it and the nation, why did it not attempt to do so? Fritsch himself gave the answer after his fall. On Sunday, December 18, 1938, he entertained the deposed Ambassador von Hassel at his manor house at Achterberg, near Soltau, which the army had put at his disposal after his retirement. Hassel noted down in his diary the substance of his views. This man, Hitler, is Germany's destiny, for good and for evil. If he now goes over the abyss, which Fritsch believes he will drag us all down with him. There is nothing we can do. With foreign, economic, and military policy concentrated in his hands, and the armed forces directly under his command, Hitler now proceeded on his way. Having got rid of Fritsch without giving him the opportunity of clearing his name, he belatedly afforded him the opportunity by setting up a military court of honor to hear the case. Field Marshal Goering presided, and at his side were the commanders-in-chief of the Army and Navy, General von Brauchitsch and Admiral Raeder, and two professional judges of the Supreme War Tribunal. The trial, from which the press and the public were excluded, began in Berlin on March 10, 1938, and was suddenly suspended before the day was over. Late on the previous night, news had come from Austria which sent the Führer into one of his greatest tantrums. When Papen arrived at the Chancellery in Berlin 36 hours later, he found Hitler still in a state bordering on hysteria. Papen, Memoirs, page 428. Field Marshal Goering and General von Brauchitsch were urgently needed elsewhere.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany, by William L. Shirer. Chapter 11. Anschluss. The Rape of Austria. Toward the end of 1937, due to a change of jobs from newspaper to radio reporting, my headquarters were transferred from Berlin to Vienna, which I had come to know as a youthful correspondent a decade before. Though I would spend most of the period of the next 3 crucial years in Germany, my new assignment, which was to cover continental Europe, gave me a certain perspective of the Third Reich and, as it happened, set me down in those very neighboring countries which were to be victims of Hitler's aggression just prior to and during the time the aggression took place. I roved back and forth in those days between Germany and the country that for the moment was the object of Hitler's fury, and so gathered a first-hand experience of the events which are now to be described, and which led inexorably to the greatest and bloodiest war in man's experience. Though we observed these happenings at first hand, it is amazing how little we really knew of how they came about. The plottings and maneuvers, the treachery, the fateful decisions and moments of indecision, and the dramatic encounters of the principal participants which shaped the course of events, took place in secret beneath the surface, hidden from the prying eyes of foreign diplomats, journalists, and spies, and thus for years remained largely unknown to all but a few who took part in them. We have had to wait for the maze of secret documents and the testimony of the surviving leading actors in the drama, most of whom were not free at the time, many landed in Nazi concentration camps, to tell their story. What follows, therefore, in the ensuing pages is based largely on the mass of factual evidence which has been accumulated since 1945. But it was perhaps helpful for a narrator of such a history as this to have been personally present at its main crises and turning points. Thus, it happened that I was in Vienna on the memorable night of March 11th to 12th, 1938, when Austria ceased to exist. For more than a month, the beautiful Baroque capital by the Danube, whose inhabitants were more attractive, more genial, more gifted in enjoying life such as it was than any people I had ever known, had been prey to deep anxieties. Dr. Kurt von Schuschnigg, the Austrian Chancellor, would later recall the period between February 12th and March 11th as the 4 weeks' agony. Since the Austro-German agreement of July 11th, 1936, in which Schuschnigg, in a secret annex to the treaty, had made far-reaching concessions to the Austrian Nazis, Franz von Papen, Hitler's special ambassador in Vienna, had been continuing his labors to undermine the independence of Austria and bring about its union with Nazi Germany. In a long report to the Führer at the end of 1936, he had reported on his progress, and a year later had done the same, this time stressing that only by subjecting the federal chancellor, Schuschnigg, to the strongest possible pressure can further progress be made. His advice, though scarcely needed, was soon to be taken more literally than even he could conceive. Throughout 1937, the Austrian Nazis, financed and egged on by Berlin, had stepped up their campaign of terror. Bombings took place nearly every day in some part of the country, and in the mountain provinces, massive and often violent Nazi demonstrations weakened the government's position. Plans were uncovered disclosing that Nazi thugs were preparing to bump off Schuschnigg as they had his predecessor. Finally, on January 25, 1938, Austrian police raided the Vienna headquarters of a group called the Committee of Seven, which had been set up to bring about peace between the Nazis and the Austrian government, but which in reality served as the central office of the illegal Nazi underground. There they found documents initialed by Rudolf Hess, the Führer's deputy, which made it clear that the Austrian Nazis were to stage an open revolt in the spring of 1938, and that when Schuschnigg attempted to put it down, the German army would enter Austria to prevent German blood from being shed by Germans. According to Papen, one of the documents called for his own murder or that of his military attaché, Lieutenant General Muff, by local Nazis, so as to provide an excuse for German intervention. If the debonair Papen was less than amused to learn that he was marked, for the second time, for assassination by Nazi roughnecks on orders from party leaders in Berlin, he was also distressed by a telephone call which came to him at the German legation in Vienna on the evening of February 4th. State Secretary Hans Lammers was on the line from the Chancellery in Berlin to inform him that his special mission in Austria had ended. He had been fired, along with Neurath, Fritsch, and several others. "I was almost speechless with astonishment," Papen later remembered. He recovered sufficiently to realize that Hitler evidently had decided on more drastic action in Austria, now that he had rid himself of Neurath, Fritsch, and Blomberg. In fact, Papen recovered sufficiently to decide to do something unusual for a diplomat, as he put it. He resolved to deposit copies of all his correspondence with Hitler in a safe place, which turned out to be Switzerland. "The defamatory campaigns of the Third Reich," he says, "were only too well known to me. As we have seen, they had almost cost him his life in June 1934. Papen's dismissal was also a warning to Schuschnigg. He had not fully trusted the suave former cavalry officer, but he was quick to see that Hitler must have something worse in mind than inflicting on him the wily ambassador, who at least was a devout Catholic, as was he, and a gentleman. In the last few months, the course of European diplomacy had not favored Austria. Mussolini had drawn closer to Hitler since the establishment of the Rome-Berlin axis, and was not so concerned about maintaining the little country's independence as he had been at the time of the murder of Dollfuss, when he had rushed four divisions to the Brenner Pass to frighten the Führer. Neither Britain, freshly embarked under Chamberlain upon a policy of appeasing Hitler, nor France, beset by grave internal political strife, had recently shown much interest in defending Austria's independence should Hitler strike. And now, with Papen, had gone the conservative leaders of the German army and foreign office, who had exercised some restraining influence on Hitler's towering ambitions. Schuschnigg, who was a narrow-minded man but within his limits an intelligent one, and who was quite well informed, had few illusions about his worsening situation. The time had come, as he felt it had come after the Nazis slew Dollfuss, to further appease the German dictator. Papen, discharged from office though he was, offered an opportunity. Never a man to resent a slap in the face if it came from above, he had hurried to Hitler the very day after his dismissal to obtain some picture of what was going on. At Berchtesgaden on February 5th, he found the Führer exhausted and distraught from his struggle with the generals. But Hitler's recuperative powers were considerable, and soon the cashiered envoy was interesting him in a proposal that he had already broached to him a fortnight before when they had met in Berlin. Why not have it out with Schuschnigg personally? Why not invite him to come to Berchtesgaden for a personal talk? Hitler found the idea interesting. Unmindful of the fact that he had just fired Papen, he ordered him to return to Vienna and arrange the meeting. Schuschnigg readily assented to it, but, weak as his position was, laid down certain conditions. He must be informed in advance of the precise points which Hitler wanted to discuss, and he must be assured beforehand that the agreement of July 11, 1936, in which Germany promised to respect Austria's independence and not to interfere in her internal affairs, would be maintained. Furthermore, the communiqué at the end of the meeting must reaffirm that both countries would continue to abide by the 1936 treaty. Schuschnigg wanted to take no chances in bearding the lion in his den. Papen hurried off to Obersalzberg to confer with Hitler and returned with the Führer's assurance that the 1936 agreement would remain unchanged, and that he merely wanted to discuss such misunderstandings and points of friction as have persisted since it was signed. This was not as precise as the Austrian Chancellor had requested, but he said he was satisfied with the answer. The meeting was set for the morning of February 12th, which happened to be the fourth anniversary of the slaughter of the Austrian Social Democrats by the Dollfuss government, of which Schuschnigg was a member. On February 12, 1934, 17,000 government troops and fascist militia had turned artillery on the workers' flats in Vienna, killing 1,000 men, women, and children, and wounding 3,000 or 4,000 more. Democratic political freedom was stamped out, and Austria thereafter was ruled first by Dollfuss, and then by Schuschnigg as a clerical fascist dictatorship. It was certainly milder than the Nazi variety, as those of us who worked in both Berlin and Vienna in those days can testify. Nevertheless, it deprived the Austrian people of their political freedom, and subjected them to more repression than they had known under the Habsburgs in the last decades of the monarchy. The author has discussed this more fully in Mid-Century Journey. And on the evening of February 11th, Schuschnigg, accompanied by his Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs, Guido Schmidt, set off by special train in the strictest secrecy for Salzburg, whence he would drive by car over the border to Hitler's mountain retreat on the following morning. It was to prove a fateful journey. The meeting at Berchtesgaden, February 12, 1938. Papen showed up at the frontier to greet his Austrian visitors, and in the frosty winter morning air seemed to be, Schuschnigg thought, in the very best of humor. Hitler, he assured his guests, was in an excellent mood this day. And then came the first warning note. The Führer, Papen said genially, hoped Dr. Schuschnigg would not mind the presence at the Berghof of three generals who had arrived quite by chance. Keitel, the new chief of OKW, Reichenau, who commanded the army forces on the Bavarian-Austrian frontier, and Sperle, who was in charge of the air force in this area. Papen later remembered of his guests that this was a piece of information that seemed little to their taste. Schuschnigg says he told the ambassador he would not mind, especially since he had not much choice in the matter. A Jesuit-trained intellectual, he was getting on his guard. Even so, he was not prepared for what now took place. Hitler, wearing the brown tunic of a stormtrooper, with black trousers, and flanked by the three generals, greeted the Austrian chancellor and his aide on the steps of the villa. Schuschnigg felt it was a friendly but formal greeting. In a few moments he found himself alone with the German dictator in the spacious second-floor study, whose great picture windows looked out upon the stately snow-capped Alps, and on Austria, the birthplace of both these men, beyond. Kurt von Schuschnigg, 41 years old, was, as all who have known him would agree, a man of impeccable old-world Austrian manners. And it was not unnatural for him to begin the conversation with a graceful tidbit about the magnificent view, the fine weather that day, and a flattering word about this room having been, no doubt, the scene of many decisive conferences. Hitler cut him short. "We did not gather here to speak of the fine view or of the weather." Then the storm broke. As the Austrian chancellor later testified, the ensuing two-hour conversation was somewhat unilateral. Later, Dr. Schuschnigg wrote down from memory an account of what he calls the significant passages of the one-sided conversation, and though it is therefore not a verbatim record, it rings true to anyone who has heard and studied Hitler's countless utterances, and its substance is verified not only by all that happened subsequently, but by others who were present at the Berghof that day, notably Papen, Jodl, and Guido Schmidt. I have followed Schuschnigg's account, given in his book Austrian Requiem, and in his Nuremberg affidavit on the meeting. "You have done everything to avoid a friendly policy," Hitler fumed. "The whole history of Austria is just one uninterrupted act of high treason. That was so in the past and is no better today. This historical paradox must now reach its long overdue end, and I can tell you right now, Herr Schuschnigg, that I am absolutely determined to make an end of all this. The German Reich is one of the great powers, and nobody will raise his voice if it settles its border problems." Shocked at Hitler's outburst, the quiet-mannered Austrian chancellor tried to remain conciliatory and yet stand his ground. He said he differed from his host on the question of Austria's role in German history. "Austria's contribution in this respect," he maintained, "is considerable." Hitler: "Absolutely zero. I'm telling you, absolutely zero. Every national idea was sabotaged by Austria throughout history. And indeed, all this sabotage was the chief activity of the Habsburgs and the Catholic Church." It is evident that Hitler's warped version of Austro-German history, which, as we have seen in earlier chapters, was picked up in his youth at Linz and Vienna, remained unchanged. Schuschnigg: "All the same, Herr Reichskanzler, many an Austrian contribution cannot possibly be separated from the general picture of German culture. Take, for instance, a man like Beethoven." Hitler: "Oh, Beethoven? Let me tell you that Beethoven came from the Lower Rhineland." Schuschnigg: "Yet Austria was the country of his choice, as it was for so many others." Hitler: "That's as may be. I am telling you once more that things cannot go on in this way. I have a historic mission, and this mission I will fulfill, because Providence has destined me to do so. Who is not with me will be crushed. I have chosen the most difficult road that any German ever took. I have made the greatest achievement in the history of Germany, greater than any other German. And not by force, mind you. I am carried along by the love of my people." Schuschnigg: "Herr Reichskanzler, I am quite willing to believe that." After an hour of this, Schuschnigg asked his antagonist to enumerate his complaints. "We will do everything," he said, "to remove obstacles to a better understanding, as far as it is possible." Hitler: "That is what you say, Herr Schuschnigg, but I am telling you that I am going to solve the so-called Austrian problem one way or the other." He then launched into a tirade against Austria for fortifying its border against Germany, a charge that Schuschnigg denied. Hitler: Listen, you don't really think you can move a single stone in Austria without my hearing about it the next day, do you? I have only to give an order, and in one single night all your ridiculous defense mechanisms will be blown to bits. You don't seriously believe that you can stop me for half an hour, do you? I would very much like